right, everybody, you heard it. We are live on Revolution Radio, Third Phase of Moon. I'm your host, Dr. J. Andy Elias. I got on the line Blake Cousins, the one and only. And we also seem to have Jack. Blake, why don't you tell us a little about Jack?
All right. Well, exciting events happening right here at Third Phase Moon. We just covered the Sirius World documentary. You were over down there. But we have our own full-length documentary, The Alien Human Project, which we just released right here on Third Phase of Moon to the public. We're not asking for money. We here at Third Phase of Moon believe the public needs to see this information, hear it, make their own decisions, but we're giving it out for free right here on YouTube, Third Phase of Moon, the world premiere, UFO sightings, The Alien Human Project. Check it out on YouTube, Third Phase of Moon. And yeah, we had Jack, a special correspondent there on the scene. John, do we have Jack on the line here now?
I believe so, yeah. Jack.
Yeah. Hey, Jack. Mr. Jack
Hello.
Graham. He's 15 years old. He's a young documentarian investigator. I was really fascinated with the questions he was asking Dr. Roger Lear in regards to removing alien implants. Tell me, Jack, what did you learn from Dr. Roger Lear, and what did you think before you met him as far as the alien abduction phenomenon?
Well, I guess the only thing I needed before I came was an open mind. It's so much information to take in. But really, the main thing that stuck out to me is how, first of all, how lucky Dr. Lear is to find these implants and how much info these implants contain. Dr. Lear told me that they contain carbon microtubing, which could be used to store a lot of information and possibly transmit it back to alien UFOs. So there's definitely a lot of possibility for research there. And I feel like if he had more funding, this could definitely be one of the main things that could probably get us contact with aliens.
Absolutely. And, you know, this format, a young man like yourself, 15 years old, you know, asking these heavy-duty questions with, you know, this Dr. Roger Lear, it was quite impressive just watching this whole production that we put out on Third Phase of Moon. Have you had a chance to view the world premiere? I think we sent you the link in private. And what did you think of it?
I did, yeah, I saw it, and I feel like it's tough to really capture all the, it's tough to capture all the way Dr. Lear states it through video in person. He's very, not intimidating, but you can tell he definitely knows what he's saying, and he's very interesting in everything he says. I think the video does a really great job kind of portraying the one-on-one interview me and him had. And a lot of stuff came out in that interview, and it was definitely a great thing to watch, and it could be very important.
Incredible. Oh, right. Dr. Andy Elias, I know you got to watch the Alien Human Project last night exclusive. What did you come away with after you watched the documentary?
Oh, Blake, I got to tell you and all the listeners out there, this is a very great documentary. Normally you'd be paying $25, $30 for something, and the fact that you gave it for the world to see for free is just an amazing thing in itself. It's a very well-produced documentary, but the implications of what Dr. Lear's research has shown are enormous. For starters, the implants themselves, when they go into the body and when they're removed, there's no inflammatory response. Any physician out there will tell you anything that goes into your body, a splinter, a kidney transplant, anything has an inflammatory response. If the medical community just looked at these implants and figured out why they didn't cause such an inflammation, then that would just recreate everything. That could solve so many of the medical problems. On top of that, the technology that goes behind these implants is so far advanced that we're aware of, it's just mind-blowing. They're sending signals that are consistent with deep space, radio signals. There are metals that don't exist on Earth and ratios that don't exist on Earth. There's just so much information. All you listeners out there, go on YouTube, find Third Phase of Moon, and look for it. The Alien Human Project. It's an amazing documentary, Blake.
Exactly. You know, Jack Graham also asked questions from the alien abductees themselves, one who wanted to remain anonymous, but she had implants removed from Dr. Roger Lear in the past, and they turned out to be extraterrestrial in origin. Also, Tim Collin. Jack, what did you think when you were interviewing these alien abductees? Did they come across as, was this kind of some kind of scam, or were they, you know, the real deal?
You know, at first, out of the whole craziness of it, you would think, oh, it would have to be fake. And that's, I'm not going to lie, that's actually how I came into it. I had my doubts at first. But after I interviewed, you know, all these people, I realized, you know, their stories all had the same things in common. And plus, you know, like you said, there's no inflammatory response. And plus, I think the really interesting thing is Dr. Lear is not doing this for profit. This is a non-profit organization that he's running, which really says something about the whole thing. He's not doing this for the money. He's not doing this for the fame. I think it's really, if this was a scam, it would be tough to fake. And I don't see the reasons for the scam. I think it's definitely legit.
You know, let me add one thing in there on top of this. Whatever Dr. Lear is doing, all the research, Dr. Lear himself invites the world to argue with the research, to argue with the academics. He's open to ask anybody looking at them, talking about them, and looking at the evidence, because once you look at it, there's no other way.
You know, when Jack spoke with scientists and material chemist, he was asking some really big questions, but when Steve Colburn pulled the implant out, you were right there on scene. What were you thinking when you watched this object come out of this test tube, and what were your thoughts at that moment?
I honestly, my heart almost froze, because I knew I was looking at something extraterrestrial, something otherworldly that could be coming from God knows how many light years away. I don't know from what other solar system, maybe another galaxy. I don't know what. But when I looked at that piece, I was astonished, to say the least.
Jack, your thoughts?
Definitely. The moment I first laid eyes on it, it's so small that I guess it would be very easy to miss. And the moment it was unveiled to me, there was something, there was something clearly strange about it, And as I was explained to it, how they've noticed that when it was in the body, it released radio wave signals. I thought that was definitely the most telling thing about it. And I think, honestly, this could be a huge indicator of what's out there. And plus, who knows how many people these implants are inside? That's something to think about as well. Who else has these implants inside of them?
Over 2 to 4 million people abducted in the United States alone are some of the estimates of what's going on. And Dr. Roger Lear's managed to remove 16 implants, if I'm not mistaken. And, when Tim Cullen, at the very end, the abductee, said that he was, as the operation was happening and the removal of this implant, he could feel like it knew it was being removed, and it didn't really want to get removed. He felt like he was at one with this object, like there was some kind of, synchronized energy going on with this object, which is very amazing to me, and it would be advanced high technology in order for this to happen.
Absolutely. And this is, like I said earlier, this is mind-blowing technology. There's stuff there that just we cannot do. I mean, the nanotubes. And, when he first removed the first implant back in 96, technology has changed dramatically since then. The electron microscopes can look deeper and deeper and deeper. It was only recently, in the last couple of years, that Dr. Lear was able to discover that they're emitting a radio frequency. That's something that wasn't known 15, 20 years ago, or almost 20 years ago, more like 17, 18 years ago. The other aspect of it is the nanotubes. That's something that was just discovered recently. And as technology gets better for us, we're going to be able to look even deeper into these things. But there's one thing that remains a fact. These do not come from Earth. That's a fact, not an opinion. That's a fact.
Now, I really want to thank Jack Graham for being on the ground, on location, and asking the world history, the questions from Dr. Roger Lear, and we got answers that we quite didn't expect, and the information came in, and it was absolutely amazing. Jack Graham, appreciate you being there and doing this amazing job.
Thank you very much. I had a lot of fun, the interview, and I definitely learned a lot so far.
If in the future, Third Phase of the Moon needs, your young talent down there on scene in regards to the alien phenomenon, you can help us out right here at Third Phase of the Moon. Right, Jack?
Definitely. Love Third Phase of the Moon.
All right. Appreciate it, Jack. And we'll see you soon.
Thank you. Bye.
You know, Blake, I believe it's the new generation, the young generation that has much more of an open mind that's changing the world. I mean, you got to remember, everybody's got to know this, it's just common knowledge that these young people are going to be the leaders of the world in 30, 40, 50 years. So if they're all having this open mind, the generation that has such a closed mind, the gap is finally getting there. So I think that may be one of the reasons why we're much closer to disclosure. You know, speaking with Dr. Lear, he's also going to be testifying at the citizens' hearing, and as is our guest, who's going to be joining us very shortly, is Richard Dolan. And I think just everything coming together at the same time, the release of this great new documentary, which everybody out there, you have to see it, at the citizens' hearing, all of this coming together, you know, maybe something is finally happening. What do you think, Blake?
You know, I think disclosure is just about to explode, because with the information coming in and this pinnacle with this meeting right there in Washington, D.C., I think the public and, like you said, the young generation are going to attach to the phenomenon and react in a way that will demand our governments, or at least our government here in the United States, to at least come forward and disclose what they know about the alien race. And the Alien Human Project, I think, is a great start to get the questions out there and get people excited about what really is going on over the skies of planet Earth and the universe.
I completely agree, Blake. And, you know, it's going to be such an amazing thing to see what happens with the citizens' hearing, and to see hopefully the young generation will be captivated and be paying attention to this. And I really hope they do. All the information is at citizenshearing.org, and they could watch it streaming live. There are going to be over 40 witnesses, some top ufologists, Richard Dolan, Dr. Lear, so many more. And we really encourage them all to come on and to look at it. In the meantime, while we get our guest on, Blake, why don't you tell the listeners out there what's new on Third Phase of Moon?
Well, you know, we just posted, obviously, the Alien Human Project a couple days ago. Some amazing footage from Joe Kiernan. We hope he's going to be calling in soon from South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, the UFO hunter out there. Captured an amazing, you know, to me it looked like a military aircraft, triangle in shape, top secret, obviously, in its way of design. But what was the most astounding thing, and at Third Phase of the Moon, we blew it up, we slowed it down, we added brightness and contrast to it, just to bring out what was really going on in this incredible video. And the thing cloaks out into invisibility, basically straight out of like the Star Trek movies, the Klingon just, you know, absolutely cloaking into to thin air. Amazing stuff. It's called UFO Sightings Cloaking Technology Exposed. Brilliant disguise by military. Hard to tell, 2013, but it's an incredible.
Blake, we got our guest on. We Mr. Richard Dolan. He's a famous ufologist. He's written three amazing books, UFOs over UFOs and the National Security State. There's volumes one and volume two. The first one's from 1941 to 1973. Second from 73 to 91. Also another famed book, AD After Disclosure. And without any further ado, Mr. Dolan.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, anytime. You know, you've written these amazing books, and you've chronicled in much detail what's been happening and what's caused the secrecy. You know, what's your overall impression of disclosure? And let's just cut to the chase with what's going to happen on Monday. You're going to be testifying in front of former members of Congress to push disclosure. What do you think is – do you think it's finally going to make something happen?
Well, this isn't the first time, of course, that there's been major gatherings in the Washington, D.C. area of this type, you know, promoting UFO reality information and trying to get the word out. So as to whether or not this is going to cause a steamroll effect and put something on the desk of President Obama to force him to disclose, I don't think anyone's expecting that. But I do think that these types of efforts are valuable. What they do at the very least is they can leave a valuable historical record. And at the most, they might be able to get a little bit of a stir going and maybe, just maybe, some positive ripple effect down the road. The thing is, you can't win unless you try. And that's what I've been involved in a number of these efforts with Stephen Bassett over the years, primarily through his many X conferences, which he had all in the DC area. And I've always believed in the effort to provide a reasoned and intelligent and, let's say, sophisticated understanding of the UFO phenomenon for people who are in a position to do something about it, for thought leaders and for other individuals who've got some ability to make things happen. I think they need to get this information in front of them. So what we're going to be doing, I'm going to be very active all week long in this. I'll be doing my own presentation, but I'm also participating in 6 panels throughout the week. So I'll be there all week. What we're going to be trying to do is to engage not only these former members of Congress, but really the public that will be attending. The event is free to the public, and it's going to be they have a lot of video recording. There's going to be a lot of ways in which this gets out to the public. So I think what we're trying to do is make a very positive, coherent statement.
You know, Mr. Dolan, just before you got on, we were talking about how the young generation has such an open mind versus those who were around during the Roswell event and may have not believed things so much because they were so bound by the laws of the universe, that we were the only planet and all that. Do you think that if we can get to this access to all these young people to actually watch this, that maybe they can actually try and force disclosure?
Well, I think you're right in that there's been a real sea change in generations. And you've seen this every generation from the 40s to the 50s and 60s and 70s and right on through to today. I've often felt that change comes less through individuals just learning and getting older and getting new ideas. I think real change comes through generations. So, individuals will change only so much, but it's their children and their grandchildren where you start seeing real change, because these are people who grew up in completely different environments. I have teenagers of my own. I see it. So I do think that in the long run, what we're seeing is a real opportunity to reach out to young people, anyone under 25, let's say, who I think are open to this. What young people usually lack is a lot of, I think, reliable knowledge about the UFO phenomenon. A lot of times you find that people need to be kind of guided a little bit in terms of understanding just why this matters. You know, why does the UFO phenomenon matter? When you look around you in the world we have today, we've got a lot of other things that can occupy someone's attention if you've got a serious mind. There's all kinds of bad and interesting things going on in the world that have nothing to do with UFOs. And if you turn on the news or CNN or MSNBC or Fox or whatever, UFOs don't usually make the cut, and there are other things that get people's attention. So someone might just wonder, well, gee, why should I really be concerned about little green men or little gray men or flying saucers? Why does that even matter? And it's the obligation of researchers like myself and other people to explain just why it does matter. And indeed, it's a very important topic, as important now as it ever has been, maybe more so.
You know, that's amazing, Richard Dolan. You know, we're getting some new footage right here from South Carolina, Joe Kiernan, and I'm downloading the footage where he explains that he had a hard time capturing these, you know, orbs in the night skies, but he absolutely nailed it this time, and we're going to take a look at this footage. So I'm going to have to get going, guys. I really appreciate Richard Dolan being here on the show, Dr. Jandy Elias. Keep up on the questions, and if anybody out there has captured anything amazing in regards to UFOs, you can contact Third Phase of Moon via Skype or Facebook. My name is Blake Cousins, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you, Blake. Back to you, Mr. Dolan. Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Brazil, as you know, they use ethanol, so they don't have to rely on the world's oil. Is it possible that they are going to defy the U.S. and the pressure that we've been putting on other governments to keep this secret and just disclose themselves?
It's an interesting question. Brazil is one of a few nations that, at least in theory, would have the ability to kind of go their own way. You know, the so-called BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, that, you know, they're not part of the kind of the U.S. hegemonic system as much as some other countries are. And might Brazil go their own way? Well, it's possible. The idea of ethanol, I think it's interesting, but it's primarily corn derived, and I don't know if you can grow enough corn in the world to feed to power all of the vehicles in this world, frankly. I think you'd be in more in danger of turning the earth into a desert if you're going to grow that much corn. That's just my take on it. But I do think this is a sign that you've got certain nations that are trying to break free of a petroleum stranglehold over them, and that's certainly a good thing. What we really need are more revolutionary radical energy developments in ethanol if we're going to really move into the kind of future that I think we need to move into. Being stuck in, whether it's a fossil fuel paradigm or burning some other kind of natural resource, I doubt seriously that that's going to be a solution for 7+ billion people in this world for much longer.
You know, I completely agree with you. The fact that we're using internal combustion engines, which is a technology that we discovered 150 years ago. Why the hell are we still using it?
Oh, well, a very, very good question. I mean, the internal combustion engine is, if you just look at it mechanically, technically, it's a thing of beauty in its own way. It's highly efficient and it has worked very well. But it's also, of course, been very amenable to control by a very small number of people in terms of its distribution of energy, oil. And so there's an obvious reason that, certain groups have an interest in keeping that as our dominant paradigm for energy and for energy generation. There has been a long history in the last 100+ years of people having apparent, let's say, probable energy breakthroughs from Nikola Tesla right on down the road to our own time now. I mean, there's constantly new individuals who've developed, whether it's engines that seem to run on water or other types of what are known as over-unity devices that might be able to provide what we might call free energy. These are claims. Some of them seem like they may have something to it, but frequently what you find is that, they get shut out. Certainly seems that way to me. And it's not hard to see why. We're in a world where you've got, everything is tied in together at the top. You have banks, which essentially are owned by the same people who own the oil companies. You've got a nice little clique of power holders at the very top of the human pyramid. And truthfully, there's no incentive that these guys have to promote any kind of change that's going to take out petroleum as our dominant paradigm. And by the way, this is one of the key reasons why the UFO phenomenon is so important, is the energy aspect of it. It's not the only thing that's important, but it's big without a doubt. As I often ask people to think about, if you visualize what a UFO can do, something that has been seen countless times, going from an indefinite hovering to an instant acceleration or making observed and measured right angle turns, what is the source of power that can allow any object to do that? It's clearly not petroleum based. It's something a lot better. Whatever that solution is, that is, it's something implicitly that our society, our civilization could be striving for. And can you just imagine what our world would be like if we were not beholden to petroleum, which has a stranglehold over our society, if there was some kind of energy breakthrough? Think of the kinds of solutions to certain problems that seem intractable now that we really might be able to explore. I think there'd be a lot of opportunity for some real positive change.
I completely agree. And the thing is, once those people who are in control, if they lost their ability for us to be controlled, I think that would be their downfall. And that's probably one of the driving forces of them covering all this up. And as you mentioned before, Nikola Tesla and other people who have brought around these free energy devices or theories, there was labs that were burned down. There were people that were murdered, suicides that were highly suspicious. That's been going on as far back as we know in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's going to take to end it, really. I really don't know. I'm very hopeful that this will come to an end soon because we are destroying our planet. But at the same time, I'm afraid they're not going to let it happen.
Well, I think it's going to happen, and I've got a couple of ideas as to how it will. Just keep in mind that it was only just over 20 years ago that, you know, we got the beginning of what we now call the internet. You know, 20 years ago, there was no World Wide Web. I mean, if you just wrap your head around that for a second, it hasn't been that long historically. And the way that the web has developed, I would say confidently, is something that those people at the top of our pyramid really could not have fully foreseen. I don't think they could have foreseen just how the world would be able to communicate globally in the way that we now do, sharing ideas in the way that we now do, developing what we now call the alternative media. There was no alternative media 20 plus years ago. Didn't exist, really. I mean, other than a couple of, magazines and privately published rags here and there that really no one read. And now the alternative media is an enormous part of human consciousness. Well, I think that there are going to be similar breakthroughs in the next 10, 20 years. One of the things that I've been looking into in the last couple of months is 3D printing. And the reason I think this is important, what 3D printing is it is a manufacturing system by which you basically plug in a CAD program, and a device will kind of extrude. Right now they mainly extrude plastic, but they'll be able to do other materials, and they'll be able to replicate.
That's right, all you listeners. We are back from the break. For those of you just tuned in, we are on with a special guest, Mr. Richard Dolan, author of the famous books, UFOs in the National Security State, Volume 1 and 2, and After Disclosure. We were just talking about the new alternative media and the 3D. Can you tell us about
that? Yeah. 3D printing, this is something that's going to revolutionize our world. I can absolutely guarantee this. Basically, the idea is this. You could, for a very little amount of money nowadays, you could buy your own 3D printer. And what it would do is if I made a CAD design, like a computer aided design of a product, I could submit it to you, and you'd actually be able to print it out. You'd be able to create it. Think of like Star Trek Replicator. That's kind of like what this thing would be like. So imagine now, think about all of the creativity that goes into creating apps for cell phones. You have all these smart people around the world creating all these amazing apps for the Android and for the iPhone, right? I mean, things that you would never have imagined a phone being able to do, your phone can do because some guy or gal, some smart person on the other side of the world thought, hey, I can make your phone do this. And you download the app and it does it. 3D printing is going to work on the same type of principle, only it'll be for manufacturing products. So think of some smart person who thinks of an engine that can run on water, or thinks of an alternative energy device in one way or another. You don't think someone's going to come up with it? Think again. 3D printing is going to be global, and it's getting to the point where they're going to be able to 3D print not just plastic parts, but integrated circuits, printed circuit boards and everything else. It's all coming. This is all coming. So in other words, the entire manufacturing paradigm is less than one generation of being completely overturned. And when that happens, all right, I really believe it's going to be impossible. I mean, literally impossible to stop every creative person around the world from coming up with their own ideas to create their own products. And so all of these alternative energy devices that have been suppressed for the last century or more, I don't think they're going to be suppressed for much longer. I think we're going to be seeing a kind of tidal wave of human creativity that's going to be kind of actuated through this new technology, this new opportunity. And that's just one thing. In other words, the future is such a hard thing to predict. But one thing we can say, I think, confidently, is that it's going to be a little bit wilder than we normally are able to imagine. I don't think anyone even 10 years ago could have been able to predict just what our cell phones can do, for example. I mean, 10 years ago, there was no such thing as YouTube, believe it or not, you know? So we're just creating new opportunities, new technologies, new ways for us to have global conversations with each other. That I think it's, you know, the position of those people at the top trying to keep everything in their control. It's like that old analogy of the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike. And you're going to stick one finger in there, but here comes another hole in it. I can stick another finger in there, and suddenly here comes the ocean. It's going to wash over the whole thing anyway. So I think it's just a matter of time. And, we're all going to live to see it. Most of us listening, most of us involved here today, I think are going to live to see these dramatic changes that are ahead.
You know, I completely agree with you. You've touched on so many important points. If someone said 50 years ago that people would be able to call from the middle of a desert with something with wireless and the same piece of device that uses to call also has a video phone, a camcorder and all these computerized parts that to them would be scary, they'd laugh at us. They would really laugh at us. But look what we've come. It's such a short time. And couple that, like you said, YouTube is literally in its infancy. But at the same time, the statistics are for every minute watched, 100 minutes or 70 hours uploaded. Like you said, it can't be suppressed long. This is the alternative media. There are ways you can now watch YouTube on your television set. I have an Xbox 360 just so I can watch YouTube on a big screen. And honestly, there are so many days that I just rather would watch something on YouTube rather than on television. And it can't be controlled. All of it can't be controlled. And I think you're right. That's going to be the biggest push.
Commercial television is becoming more and more irrelevant to the world. And unless, commercial TV can kind of keep up, as it were. The only way they can stay relevant is by keeping up with media like YouTube and with the rest of the internet, because television programmers are very aware that, of what people are interested in left to their own devices. So they're going to have to follow along with that, or they're going to be left behind.
You know, you're 100% right. As a matter of fact, as I was just browsing through YouTube channels, National Geographic, History have all uploaded everything they have onto YouTube because they realize that that's where things are going.
Yeah, for sure. And when you think about YouTube, it's the media of the people. Anyone who's got some creativity and a decent camera, and everyone's got a decent camera now, basically is able to put their own ideas and thoughts up on YouTube for the world to see. This is an incredible explosion of creativity and human expression, and it's only at the beginning. So when I was talking about something like 3D printing, that's going to be for manufacturing what the internet has been for ideas. And we're only at the beginning of that. And there are going to be many, many other breakthroughs. It doesn't mean that it's a done deal. Certainly, there are mechanisms of control that remain in place. And when I say control, I'm meaning mostly mental control. I think many people still, unfortunately, we go through our lives in a kind of mental prison much of the time. But the world is changing, and I remain very optimistic about our ability to affect positive change in the next 10, 20 years.
You know, the whole Middle East uprising everywhere, Libya, Egypt, all of that was done with people using alternative communications and cell phones that were all of the younger generation. All of those people caused the whole region to collapse, in essence. You got, the Libyan leader Gaddafi went down. You had what was his name from Egypt?
Mubarak.
Mubarak, exactly. Yeah. He was taken down just because of this. Imagine what else this can do. And I'm really hoping that this will be the key for ufology, the key to finally telling the people the truth.
Well, that was actually the theme of the book that I wrote a couple of years ago, AD After Disclosure. That was one of the primary ideas that my co-author and I really put out there. The idea of AD After Disclosure, by the way, there's been no book like it. I'm very proud of that one. Basically, ask yourself, are there UFOs and is there a cover-up? And if you think the answer to both of those is yes, which I happen to think is, then you might ask yourself, which everyone at some point does, which is, well, what happens if that cover-up were to end? How would it rock our world? How would it change our world? And that's really what AD After Disclosure is about. It's a kind of a forward-looking speculation on how the end of UFO secrecy would change our world. Also, how it might end, how UFO secrecy might end. But then what happens after that? And what we really discovered in thinking about this in as serious a way as we could is that, well, it would change our world in pretty much every important way that we can imagine. From, you know, anger and blowback over the cover-up itself, people wanted to know, oh, how the heck have you been able to keep this hidden all these years? And I think that would lead a lot of people into wanting to understand the nature of the cover-up, and that's a dangerous thing right there, but necessary, to, you know, trying to get a handle on who these other beings happen to be. Are they good, bad, indifferent to our fate, whatever? The energy paradigm, as I was talking about before, clearly even a 10-year-old kid looking up at a UFO or reads about UFOs is going to realize that they take a different type of energy. It won't take long before people, you know, once UFOs are out in the open, to ask, well, what is their source of energy and why don't we start using it? I think once that's out on the table in a public way, it's not going to take long before we kind of get a bunch of solutions to that problem. And there'll be, I think, a lot of other repercussions, social repercussions. I think you'll see kind of a replay of the 1960s, but with modern technology and modern infrastructure. In other words, I think a lot of young people after disclosure are going to look at the older crowd and they're going to say, you know, you guys lived in a lie for your entire life, and I'm not buying into that. We're looking into a new reality here for the future, and there's going to be a wholesale rejection, I suspect, of a lot of the culture that we're now living. And we're going to have to go through that whole thing and much, much more.
You know, before I go on to comment on that, I just want to tell all the listeners out there where they could find your books. Can you tell them the website, mm-hmm. Richard Dolan's website is keyholepublishing.com, correct?
That's right. And I'm very happy to say I've got a couple of great web designers right now doing a complete overhaul, remake of the site. It's not available yet, but it will be. And in fact, there's going to be a new domain name in the near future. I've gotten a few of them that I've taken out, but I think the one I've settled on is going to be Richard Dolan Press. I run a publishing company as well as writing books. That publishing company is called Keyhole Publishing. But I'm going to go through it'll have a name change. It'll be Richard Dolan Press in the near future. And that'll be the website, and it'll still be the same kind of idea. It'll feature a lot of my work and the work of the many authors that I am going to be publishing in the next month or two. I've got a bunch of new books coming out right now.
One of the authors was the Researcher of the Year from the UFO Congress, Grant Cameron. He's publishing a book with you. Isn't that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Well, Grant, we just did publish his book. He co-authored a book, and that came out earlier this year. He co-authored it with a fellow named Scott Crane, who was much more of an active UFO researcher a number of years ago, not so much today, but they wrote a really great book, and they revised it and republished it. I was their publisher. I am their publisher this year. And that book is it's already a classic. It's called UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. I would say it's probably the best book ever done in this field on high-level whistleblowers. So, in other words, people who have bona fide, known connections to high-level positions in the U.S. government and who have made some unbelievable revelations about what is going on relating to the UFO reality. And Grant and Scott, I think, put together a dynamite book, and I was very proud to be publishing that. That came out in January of this year, and it was briefly the number one ranked UFO book on all of Amazon.com. I was really excited about that. It's still selling extremely well. And that's available at Keyhole Publishing, absolutely, as well as a number of other books that I published there.
And for all those listeners out there, once again, it's Keyhole Publishing. Let me spell it for you. It's K-E-Y-H-O-L-E publishing.com. Make sure you check it out. Like Richard Dolan said, all the books available are there. And speaking of what you just said about Mr. Grant Cameron, with the whistleblowers, there are a lot of them that have come forward and are actually corroborating stories of what some of the whistleblowers that were saying, like Lazar back in the 80s, and everyone was denying. In your opinion, who are some of the top whistleblowers?
Oh, boy, it's a loaded question. Well, some of the top historical whistleblowers are no longer alive. And let me just mention some of these. And a bunch of them were very much discussed in Grant's book. One of them, I think, that is among the most interesting and really not well known was a defense scientist named Robert Sarbacher. I'll talk about him in just a minute. Another one that they wrote about at great length was a Dr. Eric Walker. And these two guys are connected. Sarbacher was a scientist highly connected to the U.S. government in the 1950s and 60s. The guy was brilliant. And in 1950, had a conversation with a Canadian researcher, Canadian government official, in which he confirmed to this Canadian official that the topic of flying saucers was considered above top secret, higher secrecy level than the hydrogen bomb. That statement did not get out for many, many years. When it came out in the late 70s, early 80s, and Sarbacher's name was connected to it, he was still alive. And a number of researchers hunted him down, basically, and got him to talk. And guess what? Robert Sarbacher did talk and, in fact, wrote a two-page single-space type memo which laid out a tremendous revelation in which he said, yes, there were retrievals of crashed UFOs. Yes, I know a number of the scientists who were involved in the committees to study these. He, in fact, gave the name of Dr. Eric Walker, who had once been president of Penn State University and was a very good friend of Dwight Eisenhower. Eric Walker was a very big wheel, maybe bigger than Sarbacher. Researchers found Walker, who was still alive, and they got an entire Grant and Scott wrote about this at length in their book, a tremendous saga of getting information out of Dr. Eric Walker. I mean, Walker talked, and then he didn't talk, and then he talked some more, and then he didn't talk. But what they got out of him is quite remarkable. You know, there are whistleblowers in later years. The problem with a lot of self-professed or, you know, people who are alleged to be whistleblowers is that to be an actual whistleblower, in my opinion, you have to have a background that is confirmable. I mean, someone's got to be able to say, oh, yes, I know for sure that this guy did work at such and such a place. And unfortunately, in my opinion, a lot of the people today who are promoted as whistleblowers, it's next to impossible to get any kind of confirmed information on the fact that they actually did what they say they did. You know, the first thing with any whistleblower is that they have to be vetted. That is, they've got to be known to have done the things they can do. You can't just claim to have flown, transported to Mars, for example, which is what some people have claimed to do, and then call yourself a whistleblower. You know, that doesn't count, in my opinion.
I agree.
All right.
You know, that's the problem, is like you said, with the whistleblowers that we have now. There's a lot of them, and I think that the self-proclaimed ones could be disinformation agents, because all you need is to throw one bad apple in this group to really destroy the good ones around it. And that's the sad part about ufology. And I think it's obviously the elitists that are doing their part just to keep this ridicule, to keep this quiet, and they're doing a good job on it, in essence.
Well, UFO research, ufology, has been a matter – it's been a target, I should say, of the U.S. intelligence community for a long time. And if someone's new to this field and they think, well, that sounds paranoid, it's actually out in the open, and it's been acknowledged by a number of intelligence groups that they actually did this. They infiltrated UFO organizations back in the 50s and 60s, right up through the 80s and 90s. Probably beyond. So we actually know this. We know for a fact that there was at least some disinformation brought into the UFO research field in the 1980s by Air Force intelligence and almost certainly CIA. So we know all of that. And from an intelligence point of view, if you're dealing with the UFO phenomenon, I mean, let's get back down to why it matters to them. Let's rewind the clock a little bit, go back to the 1940s and 50s. We know that UFOs were important to these guys because you had unknown objects that were able to do incredible things that were violating sensitive airspace again and again and again. And we know this because we fortunately have a nice stack of declassified U.S. government documents that state exactly that. These were classified at the time. During a brief window in the late 1970s, we were able to get a bunch of those documents declassified. And it's enough, in my view, to prove that there is a genuine phenomenon going on. So now just take all of that as a given. So you've got a phenomenon of unknown objects of extraordinary capabilities. How can that not be of national security importance? Well, obviously it is. And if you can't control these objects, you don't necessarily want the public talking about it freely, because who knows how bad this conversation might get. If you can't control these things, you don't want this to be a big, big political issue. So what they try to do is control it. And you control it through infiltration and disinformation. They can't hide certain things forever. You know, they know it's inevitable that information will eventually leak out in one form or another. So what you do is you make sure that some of the information that comes out is kind of like nonsense. And, you know, get enough of that nonsense out there, and it becomes very easy for the media and for political groups to portray it as, you know, those crazy UFO people talking about, you know, fill in the blank of whatever kind of crazy theory you want to talk about. So there is disinformation that has gone out there as a way of protecting the actual secrets. And it becomes very difficult, I think, for genuine researchers sometimes have to sift through all of that. You know, we do what we can do. My attitude with the UFO phenomenon is always to be as careful as I can be. That is to know what is exactly confirmed. And then really all you can do is use your best judgment in trying to fill in those blanks. But, you know, the good news for people like us who actually care about the truth is that time is on our side. I firmly believe this. As I wrote in AD After Disclosure, we're in such a revolutionary period these days in terms of technology. You know, something like WikiLeaks, for example, didn't exist 10 years ago because it couldn't exist 10 years ago because we didn't have the global technological infrastructure for WikiLeaks to exist. And now it's here. And what new developments will there be in the next 5-10 years down the road that are going to force more secrets out? And at some point, the secrets are going to come out in such a way that they will not be able to be contained.
I completely agree with you there. And with WikiLeaks, Mr. Julian Assange, he did such a great job getting some of this information out. Yet all of a sudden, there it goes. He's being prosecuted. It's almost as if he's being selectively prosecuted just because of who he is and what he's saying.
Yeah. Right. I think there's no question about that.
And that's what's scary to a lot of people who want to come forward and want to release his documents. But I think you're right. If there's enough people, like you said, a tidal wave, when you gave that example of the kid with the in the dike holding that little hole, how many holes can they keep plugging before that whole ocean blows it over? You know, it's just a matter of time. I wanted to ask you something else too. Obviously, your book goes back to 47, and there's reports of you know, the mystery airships that were going in 1896. There's possible Aurora 1896 crash, which I don't know. To me, it's questionable. I'm still on both sides of it. I don't know. I'm on the fence on that one. But I wanted to ask you that during the Third Reich, Hitler's Germany, he obviously had this enormous might, and people were talking about this wonder weapon that he had. Do you think it's possible that there was a crash and retrieval prior to Roswell in Hitler's Germany?
Yeah, actually, my first volume of history starts in 1941, not 1947. So that my first book did cover all of World War II. So that I was able to discuss the Foo Fighter phenomenon. That's World War II UFOs. but yeah, I mean, there's a history of UFOs that go prior to that for sure. And I'll deal with the airship phenomena of the 19th century just for a moment. And I know we got to go to a break in 3 minutes, so I'm going to be mindful of that. There were a number of bizarre UFO sightings in the 19th century and prior. Actually, there are some very intriguing and I think persuasive UFO stories that go back through the centuries. We don't have as many of them, of course, but we do have some. And they, you know, when you get into the details, they're certainly going to make you scratch your head and wonder a little bit. So there's a report from 1845 of an object or something coming out of the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Sicily.
That's right, everybody. We are back. I'm your host, Dr. J. Andy Elias. And for those of you just tuning in, we are on with famed author and researcher, Mr. Richard Dolan. For all you listeners out there, be sure to check out his books. He's got three amazing ones and more to come. The first two are UFOs and the National Security States, Volume 1 and 2, and AD After Disclosure. You can find them all at keyholepublishing.com. Keyhole, K-E-Y-H-O-L-E, publishing.com. And without further ado, Mr. Dolan, let's go back to what we were talking about just before the break, which was we were talking about the airships and everything pre-41.
Right. Well, there's, you know, when I started researching UFOs, about 20 years ago, and you got to start from someplace. So I didn't really have a whole lot of knowledge about a lot of the ancient UFO history at that time. So I really started out with a lot of the modern history. But as I stayed in this longer, what became obvious to me is that there's a long, long history of, let's just say, suggestive UFO accounts going way back. I do think that some of the claims that you hear on shows like Ancient Aliens are a bit of a stretch. But nonetheless, I think there's a good case to be made that this goes back a long way. And as I was saying just before the break, there are some very interesting stories going back centuries, and that, you know, don't seem like they are easily explainable in any other way other than some kind of intelligently operated aerial vehicle. So that we can say that about that whole aspect of it. Now, when you're getting into the 20th century, you mentioned the German connection of World War II. You know, the Germans under the Nazis, under the SS, did have some quite unusual physics, some very unusual types of designs, aircraft types that they were developing. We all know about the V-2 rockets, and now many of us have learned about some of the more exotic things that they're working on, the Hanabu craft and the famous Bell, Die Glock, and a number of other things that were operating on some of them principles of physics that seemed really out there. The Bell, for example, is an alleged experimental device that seems to have had an ability to, who knows what this thing was able to do. I mean, the claims are that it almost manipulated time and space in one way or another. We don't really know. Probably the best, most detailed work on this has been done by my friend Dr. Joe Farrell in a number of his books. But, you know, the question has been raised, was there a UFO crash that the Germans had in their time that gave them kind of a head or a lead on looking into this? And all I can say is that it's been a rumor for many, many years, and I've not personally encountered any kind of historical data that makes me think, yeah, for sure it happened. But having said that, hey, you know, who really knows for sure? A lot got destroyed during the Second World War, and a lot got confiscated, and maybe there are certain things we may never know.
That's right. You know, you hit the nail right on the head. We had Project Paperclip, and right after, we offered some of those Nazis, hey, we're either going to imprison you, or why don't you come to us and come on our side and bring your research, and we'll fund you, we'll house you, we'll give you pay.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that Wernher von Braun, you know, he was the father of NASA, and he was a Nazi.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that Paperclip was a project that went over and above and beyond and around the U.S. State Department. You know, after World War II ended, it was illegal to bring Nazis into the country. We had just fought a war against them, right? They were the enemy. Americans hated them. The problem from the military's point of view is that a lot of those Nazis were considered very valuable, whether for their science, which was the main prize, but also for their intelligence, that is, intelligence against the Soviets. The Germans had something known as the Abwehr. It was Hitler's secret service, Hitler's intelligence service. And they were the most expert people in the world on studying and analyzing the Soviet Union. And the United States wanted those guys. And the fact that they were Nazis, and some of them unrepentant, hardcore Nazis for the rest of their life, was an inconvenient fact, but it didn't really stop the Americans from bringing these guys over. But they had to do it very quietly. And they did it, again, this is important, not only without the knowledge of the American people, which they did, but they did it without the knowledge of high-level American government officials. For example, like in the State Department, which was they had to get around that. That was an important thing. So in other words, we had this major covert op that was secret from most of our own government. And they brought these Nazis in. And it wasn't really something that was known for many decades, quite a few decades. It didn't really get out there until around 1990, the early 90s. So a long time went by before paperclip really became part of our common language.
You know, and that, what you just said of how it was covered up to within our own government, just goes to prove that when all those admirals and generals say, there's no UFO cover up because I'm a general and I would know. Well, obviously, if other people are excluded, including the president, why wouldn't this be happening?
Well, exactly. And I'll tell you and your listeners a story. Speaking of whistleblowers, there's one gentleman that I've been lucky to have a number of conversations with. The day is going to come when I put his name out there. I can't really feel obligated to do it yet. But this is a man who was very high level with CIA for many years and who is on a first name basis with a number of former U.S. presidents, with a number of former CIA directors, a number of former secretaries of defense. So he's at that level. Okay. And he knows a lot of those people of those three positions. And it just so happens that I have gotten to chat with him every now and then, and we seem to be friendly. So naturally, I asked him a question that anyone would want to ask him, which is like basic. You know, what does the president know about UFOs? Everyone wants to know the answer to that question. And his answer to me was very interesting. He said, well, some know more than others. He said, you know, think of it this way. This is a long-term problem that is basically being run by long-term bureaucrats who are there for life. President, on the other hand, is in office for 4 years, maybe 8 years tops. He comes and he goes. And this man said to me, some presidents are more reliable than others. And really not all of them were equally briefed on this matter. And the other thing he said to me is that he had long conversations with many of former president, CIA directors and secretaries of defense about UFOs after they retired. And he said to me, their reactions fell into three basic groups. So very small number of them said, UFOs, what's wrong with you? You're crazy. Stop wasting your time with that nonsense. Very few people. Another very small group of people said, ah, UFOs. Yes, that's very interesting, and I do know a little bit about it. Let's exchange some notes. But he said the largest group were people who said, UFOs, seriously? Tell me what you know, because I've been trying to find out, and I have no information about that. Now, these are individuals really at the highest level, as you know, of the U.S. government. I mean, it doesn't get any higher than president and CIA director and secretary of defense. And he said most of those, not all, but most, were interested, but they were kind of locked out of information. And that led me to ask him, you know, well, where do you think this information is being kept? And his only answer was, he said, well, I think it's something like the Bilderberg Group or something like a private group that goes beyond government, to which I certainly agreed. But this is a guy who's at the top, or he's dealt with the top for many, many years, and that was his own assessment. So I just thought it'd be interesting, and I wanted to share that.
You know, you actually just made me think of one theory that I have that actually scares me. When the time of World War II and Roswell, especially with Roswell, we knew the U.S. Air Force was involved and the government was involved. But I fear that over the decades, a lot of this technology was handed into private military industrial corporations who don't have to answer to the people. Do you think that may be a big obstacle to disclosure?
Well, that's a huge element of the problem. I've been writing about this, thinking about this for years and years. The privatization of secrecy is a core issue. Yes, that's exactly what's happened. You go back to the 1940s and 50s and, you know, just pretend that Roswell happened, which I think it did. And there are a number of other incidences as well where we recovered exotic technology that we didn't create. Okay, so let's just say that happened. So you're the Army. Now you've got this stuff. Well, what do you do with it? Well, eventually you're going to have to get it to private industry because those are the places where they've got the science and the engineering that will allow them to study and hopefully replicate some of this. I mean, these are your defense contractors. So obviously you need to get this to them. So how do you do that? Well, you make arrangements. You have to bring them in very classified, compartmented manner, a little bit of technology here and a little bit there, and you have those people study it and so forth. And at a certain, so then the question becomes, who owns this? Who's in control? Is it the Army? Is it Lockheed or Boeing or General Dynamics or General Electric? Well, I think what happens is it becomes privatized increasingly. And especially if you, general, you get to retire at the end, what happens? You get hired by GE as a senior VP and you get assigned to that project. I mean, everything gets privatized because that's where the money is. And once the secret becomes privatized, as you were just mentioning a moment ago, private corporations are impervious to Freedom of Information Act requests anyway. So, in other words, the secret doesn't become classified so much as proprietary. And that, I think, is a real important key when we start talking about UFO secrecy, is that it's gone beyond the public realm into the private. And if someone really finds that difficult to swallow, I would just ask them to forget UFOs for a minute and just look at U.S. foreign policy, look at the U.S. government or any government for that matter, and ask yourself to what extent that government is really dominated by private money. And I think pretty much we all understand that just about every government on planet Earth, and especially the United States, is dominated by private money, which really runs the show.
Yes, especially all those black budget projects. Mr. Dolan, I'd like to let all the listeners know that our co-host Preston Dennett, a MUFON researcher of over 23 years, has joined us, and he has a question for you. Preston, are you out there?
I'm here. Hi, John. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Preston.
It's an honor to meet you. I love your book. It's one of the few books I recommend to people who are skeptics. And I think it's a very powerful testament to the whole reality of this phenomenon.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, my question is regarding Colonel Philip Corso and this whole reverse engineering claims that he has made. I'm wondering what's your take on him, because I know he's kind of split the UFO field.
Oh, he sure has, without a doubt. You know, for years I was, like a lot of topics in the UFO field, I just ran away in terror from, and Corso was one of them. Of course, you know, eventually I'm in a position where I have to confront these things, and I'm getting dragged into it and make a decision. And Philip Corso is one of them. I never met Corso, unfortunately. I would like to have. I can say I've interviewed a number of people who did know Corso, and I have his book. I have the first edition of his book, which it's called The Day After Roswell. And seen a lot of his videos. I think, you know, I've gotten a pretty good handle on Corso as far as I can do so. One thing that has to be said about Corso's book is that it's riddled with mistakes, riddled with errors. I had a long conversation on one occasion with Bill Burns, his co-author, about those mistakes, which I've always felt have permanently damaged the credibility of his argument. And what Bill Burns said to me was that, yes, there are lots of mistakes, and it was inevitable because we just rushed the book out to get it out in time for the 50th anniversary of Roswell. There was a big contract with Simon Schuster, I think was the publisher. And he said, you know, we plan to make those corrections for next edition, and then Corso died, which, I mean, all that did happen. So, okay, fine, that could be your excuse, and maybe that's a valid one, but nonetheless, it's made the book damaged goods forever and ever, amen. I mean, that's it. So you're going to have always this one camp of researchers who are going to look through Corso's book and find mistakes. It's like shooting fish in a barrel because it's the easiest thing to do because there's mistakes all over the place. And then on top of that, I mean, there are claims that he makes in there that some people just find very difficult. You know, the fact that he said he saw an alien body in 1947, and the fact that, you know, here he is in 1961 and he's given this old filing cabinet with Roswell technology and he's giving it off to private industry, and people are thinking, well, that doesn't seem very realistic. I mean, who would do that? But there's something about Corso that makes me hesitate before I dismiss all of that. A couple of things, actually. One is that, I mean, right off the bat, when he asked his friend, Senator Strom Thurmond, to write a foreword to this UFO book, Thurmond, who had known him for years, said absolutely, and wrote in that foreword about Phil Corso as this great American, a great American hero.
Didn't he believe that that book was a different subject, though? I heard something.
Oh, absolutely. Corso was very cagey about that, and didn't let Thurmond know that this was a UFO book. And then, of course, once the book came out, it caused this firestorm of publicity, and all these reporters are in Thurmond's office, and here's Strom Thurmond, probably 158 years old or whatever he was at the time, very old man, saying, I don't know nothing about any UFOs, and that foreword was pulled immediately from the book. But all I'm saying is that Corso was a known guy in Washington and had a very good reputation in the military and in the political community. He was very highly regarded.
I mean, no one could ever mess with his credentials, all the skeptics.
No, he was a real player, and in fact had made a name for himself previously by talking about the MIA issue, missing in action. So Corso had some credibility, and here he is talking about UFOs, and yes, I mean, admittedly, it's pretty much out there. But the other problem with Corso is that the actual manuscript that he wrote, I mean, he was 80 years old or so when he wrote that, and he was practically deaf, and he wasn't computer literate, and he just hand wrote this jumbled mess of notes, essentially is what he ended up doing. Now, from a researcher point of view, all of that would be very interesting, but what Burns did is he took that and he kind of turned it into a story, because Burns can write. But what I think happened is that a lot of liberties were taken and a lot of mistakes were made. So Corso's original message, I think, got really damaged in the process. So that, you know, forever after, Corso's just this guy who's spouting his mouth off and really didn't have a whole lot to say and was lying about this and that. I think that the reality is a little bit more complex than that. And I do believe that Corso was involved in some way with the transfer of, I don't know if it was Roswell technology or some other kind of exotic technology, but that he was involved in passing it off. I suspect that what he had access to probably wasn't Roswell. He may have said it was, but the fact is that there were a lot of probable recoveries of UFO technology that took place in the 40s and 50s, and it could have been any number of those things.
Right, right. Another question I'm interested in is, you know, the whole UFO field was largely ignored by, I think, society in terms of, you know, not the military and the government, but in terms of, you know, citizens. And some of the first UFO researchers were, true honest to God, pioneers fighting, you know, a whole Davy and Goliath battle against this government cover-up. People like, you know, James McDonald and Jim Carl Lorenzen and Scully. And I know in your book you mentioned Kehoe is playing a real pivotal role against this whole thing. So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Oh, I'd love to. Donald E. Kehoe was really, I think, the first truly important UFO writer, at least in the United States. He was a retired Marine Corps major. He had been a friend of Charles Lindbergh and, in fact, toured with Lindbergh in the aftermath of Lucky Lindy's first flight across the Atlantic Ocean. So Kehoe was a guy who knew aviation very well and had a very good military career. He was very good friends with...
He was a major, isn't that correct? Major Donald?
He was a retired major from the Marine Corps, and that's correct. He had studied, he had gone to Annapolis Naval Academy, and was very good friends with the first director of the CIA, Roscoe Hillencoder, who was a Navy admiral, and who was also a member of Kehoe's organization of UFOs called NICAP. The thing about Kehoe is he wrote, let's see, five important books on the topic of UFOs during the 1950s and 60s and early 70s. He was the first guy ever to write about what became known as the Robertson Panel. He learned about it almost right away in 1953 and wrote about it in a book. He was that kind of a guy. He was able to get some very, very good declassified information. This is before Freedom of Information Act, but Kehoe was able to get information declassified simply for him, and he put it out there in his books. got a lot of generals angry at him, actually. But he was convinced early on that the UFO phenomenon was extraterrestrial, and he was a pretty good writer and wrote a number of best-selling books to that effect, mainly during the 50s. That was his best period. And I think, you know, later researchers certainly owe him a debt of gratitude.
Absolutely. I mean, I've got all his books, and I'm worried that, you know, people today are forgetting how the credibility of this man.
Well, what I try to do when I wrote my very first volume of UFOs and the National Security State, one of my motivations, honestly, was to preserve the essence of what writers like Kehoe and James and Coral Lorenzen and some of these early researchers. I was afraid that their work was going to be lost forever, and I tried very hard to do justice to a lot of the research that they did in those years, and to kind of bring it back to life, as well as to work off of the declassified literature.
You know, I agree, and you have done such an amazing job with your books, and that's why they revolutionized ufology. You know, when the first volume of UFOs in the National Security State came out, it touched all those bases that many people forgot, especially the younger generation. But let me take this time real quick to segue to let you guys know we have a caller calling from South Carolina, Joe Kiernan. Are you on the line?
I am here. How are you tonight?
Excellent. You have a question for Mr. Dolan?
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Dolan, how are you tonight?
Hi, Joe. Nice to have you on.
Thank you. First, I wanted to compliment you. I did catch your last show. And when dealing with when dealing with a fresh topic involving such emotion as the recent bombings, when you addressed it with alternative ideas and motives so close to it happening, you handled it very well and with a lot of confidence. And want to thank you for that, because a lot of people did have a lot of second questions and a lot of other ideas, and it was a hush-hush thing until you really broke the ice.
Well,
so with that said, thank you very much. And I was hoping to fill you in. I was calling in to mention that I had visited the Myrtle Beach UFO exhibit here.
Hmm.
And it's a very nice thing what they're doing there. It's in a high traffic area. It'll get a lot of volume through there. They did a very nice job laying it out from prehistoric man, all the cave drawings up through Sumeria, through Egypt, and all the way through. They painted a nice timeline, and it's a very nice education piece, and they involved a lot to really get the message out there. I think all in all, the message is good, and it's getting it to the masses, and I really think that's what it's really going to take.
I'd like to get out there to look at it myself. So sometime.
It's really good. They did a good job. I really didn't have any expectations going in there. I went in there with an open mind about it all and trying to see it from a different point of view. But, Mr. Dolan, with the disclosure meeting coming up that you're going to be attending, what do you think Congress's reaction is going to be to all of this?
Good question. Well, if past history is any guide, the reaction might be fairly minimal. The United States Congress has not yet taken the lead from any of these major press conferences that have been taking place. And, you know, let's keep in mind, this has been going on for more than a decade. Stephen Greer back in 2001 had a massive one, got a lot of attention, a lot of major media attention, and Congress did nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. Stephen Bassett, who did six, I believe, ex-conferences over the last decade. I spoke at every one of those. I think I'm the only one who actually did every one of those conferences. We spoke at the National Press Club, got, in some cases, some major media attention, but again, no action by Congress. Robert Hastings and Bob Salas did a very fine press conference a couple of years ago on UFOs and nukes. That also got mainstream media attention, got nothing but no action by Congress. Leslie Kane and James Fox organized a very good conference back in 2007, a very good one. Dealing with witnesses. And again, nada from Congress. So things can always change.
That's really what it is right now, isn't it?
It's, Congress just won't touch
this. We want a reaction.
Now. Yes, we do. And I don't want to sound like a pessimist here going into this, but I think that what the more realistic goal for these types of conferences is to try to elevate public consciousness, public opinion on the matter. And the good news is that, you know, as every year goes by, I mean, the groups and people who are putting these things on, I think they're able to knock their game up just a little bit more so that we have a better ability to put together a sophisticated, really professional-looking presentation that because this conference is going to have two lives. It's going to be the live conference of next week, but it's also going to have a life in the aftermath through, you know, countless videos that will be out on YouTube and that are just going to go viral. So
that's right, everybody. We are back. I'm your host, Dr. J. Andy Elias. We got co-host Preston Dennett on. We also have famed author and researcher, Mr. Richard Dolan. Before we pick up where we left off with the caller, Joe Kiernan, I'd like everyone to know what's happening in the coming weeks, just as a reminder. Next week, on May 2nd, we have Jordan Maxwell. On May 9th, the week after that, we have Jaime Masson. The week after that, May 16th, we have Yvonne Smith. So join us again here on Revolution Radio at 5 to 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, without any further ado, let's go back and pick up where we left off just before this last break. Joe, you were asking him, Mr. Dolan, about the citizens' hearing and what Congress's reaction is going to be.
That's correct. The reaction, I suppose the reaction would be a good response for me. It would be a good beginning. More awareness, in my opinion. But I'm not the expert on it. But I believe we need a few more people out there to take it more serious. Even when they know it's a matter that should be taken serious. It's still a little touchy of a taboo, and there's a poor stigmata with it. It's sad, but that's how it is. And Mr. Dolan and a lot of his colleagues are very well known, highly recognized, incredible people. And if we can't get people to take them serious, I really don't know. How much of an effort it's going to be.
Well, I'm kind of with you on that. We do our best, but some of the criticisms that I encounter, especially regarding my friend Stephen Bassett, who I've known Stephen now for, 13 years, which blows my mind. It's like they expect him to do what? I mean, to, you know, turn the world upside down with a hearing, and that if he doesn't do that, then they're just say, well, this is a waste of time. I mean, I'm astonished sometimes by some of the really petty sniping that I do hear among people in the UFO related field. Sure. I mean, I think disclosure is kind of like not going to happen next week. I think that that's kind of a silly fantasy. But again, we got to look at the longer term picture here. I mean, would we be better off if Dr. Greer had never done the disclosure press conference? I mean, could we really think that we'd be better off without it? As flawed as that may have been in some ways, I think we're better off for having had it and for all of these other events as well. And I think that this one will take its place as a more than worthy addition to that tradition.
Yeah, it looks like.
I hope so. I really do. I appreciate all the work you're doing for it.
Thank you. I'll just add, I mean, what Steve Bassett has done, no one has done anything on this magnitude. People need to understand, this is a week-long extravaganza. I myself am making 7 appearances during the week. I'm doing one hour-long lecture, and I'm appearing on 6 panels through the week. Wow. I think that might be the most of anyone, but there are a number of people who are doing it. So they're going all week. I mean, there's Monday right through Friday. It's open. It's free to the public. So there's going to be panels, discussions all day throughout the day. And then there's lectures in the evening. I mean, and he's gotten individuals, not just former members of Congress, but some really high quality researchers and names who are going to be at this conference, who are going to be speaking. I mean, it's really a remarkable collection of research and talent that's going to be there, that of individuals who really know how to talk about this in an effective way to the public. So I think look for this to be a quite powerful sort of gathering. No one's done anything like this. This is vastly beyond in scope. But Steve Bassett is nothing if he doesn't have ambitious dreams. He always has. And, you know, he's like a brother to me in many ways. And just like an older brother, sometimes you hate him, but sometimes you love him. Every time Stephen calls me, this is exactly what he says. Richard, I need you to do something really important for me. And then it's inevitably, okay, well, what now, Steve? And so he's had me hopping around doing a lot of things in preparation for this, sending books to the members of Congress, some of my books, preparing my own kinds of presentations that he wants me to do. He keeps adding on more and more things that I'm going to be doing. He's putting me to work, but I do this because I respect him and I do believe in his vision. I've had many disagreements with Stephen over the years about whether or not disclosure is going to happen. I tend to be a little more outwardly skeptical about it, at least in the near term, but I believe in it, and so I work for it, and I think it's a worthy goal. But yeah, I mean, this is not any of the other events of the past were usually like one day or maybe one weekend events. This is a full week. It's really quite remarkable.
Well, it looks to me like disclosure is going to be a step-by-step process. It's not going to happen all at once. When I got involved in this field in 1988, disclosure was rumored to be like right around the corner. And
it
never really happened. But at this point, we're almost at a point where it's like an open conspiracy. I mean, disclosure is, to a large extent, has already happened. And when you look at surveys, more people believe that our government is hiding information about UFOs than actually believe in UFOs. So,
no, your point is very well taken, Preston. I agree with you. What's happened is that our culture is running ahead of the political system. And at some point, and I think the reason that's happening is in large part because of the technological transformation and of the internet. Again, we're all able to talk to each other in ways that we really couldn't even conceive of even 20 years ago. So that it's changed the culture. And you know, and then we're also post 9/11, and I think a lot of young people just sort of get the idea that their government's really not truthful to them. And if I can just backtrack a little bit, I was very gratified earlier, John, when you talked about my first book and how revolutionary it was. And I look back at that first book now, and I actually, what strikes me about it is how tame it is. But I wrote that book. It came out initially in 2000 and then was republished in 2002, so over a decade ago. And for its time, I mean, I look back and it really was a revolutionary book. What I tried to do in that first volume of UFOs and a National Security State was to do something that no one else had really done, which is to try to incorporate the UFO phenomenon as part of the mainstream of our history and to sort of integrate the UFO reality with a political analysis that told a coherent story. And that was radical. However, right after that book came out, around that time was 9/11, and our entire country and world just went through this true revolution from above, as I see it. And it radicalized much of the world, as we now have seen. I mean, this is absolutely what's happened. And so we've all raced far ahead, I think, of where we were prior to 9/11, myself included. So when I look back at my very first volume of that book, I think it's a worthy book, and I'm very proud of it. But if I were to redo that book, I would probably make it a bit more radical than it is, for sure.
What would you put in it that's not in it?
Well, I think I would put in more of a political analysis, which is what I did in my second volume of UFOs in the National Security State. That second volume came out in 2009, and it covers where the first volume left off. So that goes from 1973 to 1991, the end of the Cold War. And in that book, I did a couple of things that I feel like I overlooked in the first book. One was the whole German Nazi UFO connection, actually.
Right.
First book, if there's one major weakness of that first book I did, is that I didn't yet have a full appreciation of the whole Nazi UFO phenomenon. I wouldn't say I discounted it completely, but, you know, also I wrote that book before Nick Cook did The Hunt for Zero Point, before Joseph Farrell did any of his books. There wasn't really a whole lot of research on it, so I'm not going to beat myself up. But if I were to redo that book today, I would incorporate that. I did incorporate a lot of that for the second volume of UFOs in the National Security State. I just worked it in. And then there's just a lot of, like, meta-political analysis. I actually talked about the Bilderbergs. I talked about sort of the power behind the scenes and trying to understand what their motivations might be in relationship to this topic. A little more speculative, but I think it was useful. And also in that second volume, I coined the phrase breakaway civilization, which I'm seeing everywhere. Alex Jones just mentioned it again today, I think. My concept of what that actually is and how that fits into the whole larger picture, that was something that I created, I thought of in the second volume of that history. So I try to be more analytical, I think, in as I get older in this field and try to go a little deeper.
Well, here's a million-dollar question. Why do you think the UFOs are here? I mean, why are they so interested in us? And you didn't cover a whole lot about abductions in your book. I'm wondering what you think of all of that, if that's one of their
yeah.
agendas.
Actually, in my second volume, I have quite a bit on abduction, and in AD After Disclosure quite a bit. And in the new book that I'm just about to publish any month, within 2 months, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, which is like a new introduction to ufology. I've quite a bit on abduction there. I think they're here for a reason. I think they are interested in us. I suspect that anyone who's anybody in this part of the galaxy who can get here is probably here now, because I think they can tell that humanity is in the process of reinventing itself. I mean, you know, think about where we were just 150 years ago, 200 years ago. It's not that long ago in the large scheme of things. Well, 200 years ago, we were a world of horses pulling wooden carts, as I like to put it. So we go from that, and basically snap your fingers, you know, in the blink of an eye, we go into the world that we have now, which is all of this, all of what we have here, and we're not done. You know, we're moving into a world, next generation of advanced artificial intelligence, advanced nanotech, advanced things like quantum computing. And I was talking earlier about 3D printing. We're revolutionizing our world. We've mapped the human genome. We're going to be reinventing literally the human species. Bet on it. We're going to be having basically cybernetic human beings. Bet on it. All in the next couple of generations. In other words, we're not going to look anything like we do. And even 50 years from now, we're going to be a totally different society, qualitatively different. So any observing group that's watching us must know that we are about to leap right into their world. They must know this as I see it. And so, of course, they're going to be watching us right now. We're really walking a tightrope. We're right now, we've gone from the old cliff and we're on this high tightrope. You know, like in the Roadrunner cartoons where he's over the cliff. And that's us right now. And if we get to the other side of that, though, we'll make it. If we fall, if we have some kind of infrastructure collapse, in other words, all bets are off, I suppose. But if we make it, if we get through this, we're in for a wild ride in the future. And it seems to me that other groups, species, intelligences, civilizations, they must know this. And I would think they're here for the greatest show in this quadrant of the galaxy right now, which is humanity.
Well, they could end the cover-up overnight. And they seem like they're pushing towards disclosure with, you know, events like Gulf Breeze and Phoenix Lights and Hudson Valley and all these flaps that we continue to go on. So, I mean, they're not going to go away.
Yeah, trying to understand the motivations of these other beings is really, on the one hand, it might be the single most important question of UFO studies, but it's also the single most difficult one. It's the most frustrating because how do we get inside their big old heads and know exactly what they're thinking? Really, the best that I can imagine is simply inferring from their actions. One of the things is they seem to operate by stealth. That is, they don't seem to be interested in landing on the White House lawn and saying, take me to your leader. That's not what they're about. They do seem to be operating in a way that is not dealing with us in an official capacity, in an open capacity. Maybe they don't see us as equals. You know, I often wonder if we were studying some other species of animal, in some other part of the world, say gorillas in southern Africa. Well, it's not like we're going to go walk up to the lead gorilla and say, hey, how are you doing? Let's establish diplomatic relations. We're not going to do that because we wouldn't think that they would have that ability. So I, you know, you have to wonder, are these other species looking at us in that kind of a way and think, well, you know, humans don't have the capability. And the other thing that I really wonder, and this is one of these little thought experiments that I often do, just imagine like that the three of us went back in time, even only 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago, we go back in time. So we're not even going to another species. We're going back to see human beings in the year like 1,000, right? So you look at the world at that time and ask yourself this, how much would we be able to tell those people about our world? I think the answer would be very little.
Not a lot. Right?
Very, very little. I mean, ask yourself, what could we tell them scientifically? You take the smartest, you know, person in that society and you say, well, hey, guess what? The Earth actually goes around the sun, believe it or not. And he'd be like, no way, dude. And we'd be like, yes. And his head would be like ready to pop right there. And then we talk about bacteria or, you know, molecules or tectonic plates or, you know, fill in the blank. There's only so much that they're going to be able to handle without really truly collapsing. And without the society collapsing, honestly. I mean, so we wouldn't be able to tell them much that's truthful. And that's if we have their interests in mind. If we don't have their interests in mind, if we really want to screw with these people, we could turn ourselves into gods, or we could just tell them any old thing we wanted and manipulate them and use them to our heart's content. And who knows if that's the case? We really don't know. I don't think we're operating at their level. One of the things that we can certainly see from all of the stories of contact is that these beings certainly appear to be intensely telepathic. They can get inside our heads. They're able to manage our memories. They're able to erase our memories. They're able to put in screen memories. Now, that may be for our best interest, or maybe it isn't. But whatever it is, we're not at their level. And they probably are thinking, humanity, no, we cannot tell them what we're doing because A, either they cannot possibly conceivably handle it, or B, they'd get really annoyed or angry if we told them. So I think that's really what it is. You know, we have this assumption as a society that, well, we can handle anything. We can handle the truth. It's an assumption that I live by, but, you know, in certain moments we must ask ourselves, can we really handle the truth? What if it's a really dark truth? Every now and then you get hints that that this is a very, very dark kind of reality. I don't, you know, this is where I, you know, Stephen Greer just put out his new movie, Sirius, which I just saw today, actually. And whereas actually I think a lot of it's laudatory and noteworthy and useful, I have always parted ways with him in the general assessment of who these other beings are. I'm not saying that there are no positive ETs. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that I think some of them aren't necessarily beings that I would want to leave my kids alone in a room with. That's my own assumption. So I think they're not all sweetness and light.
Well, I'm wondering if, you know, the government studies on this, the official ones, Robertson Panel, Condon Committee, Blue Book, all found that UFOs represented no threat to national security. And I'm wondering, when obviously they do, if they're, you know, chasing our planes and hovering over our power plants and shutting down missiles and so on.
Yeah, or if our planes are chasing them, which is, you know, goes back for, it's a 70-year history at the least where we're chasing these things down. It's obviously connected to national security, and it's just a bald-faced lie on their part.
Well, do you think, yeah, that's my question. Do you think these studies are just pure cover-up, or were they just the military bungling through this as best as they could, or, you know?
I think it's, excuse me, primarily the former, but a little bit of the latter. I mean, it's bungle up by design. The people who are in the military intelligence community are very intelligent. I mean, when we make the joke that military intelligence is an anachronism or is a contradiction in terms, that's really not true. They're very, very smart. They're very astute. If I'll tell you right now, if a military intelligence group made it its primary goal to get to the bottom of the UFO mystery, they would make some pretty good progress. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, I assume they're doing that.
Yes, absolutely. But what they cannot do, what they absolutely cannot do, is be honest with the public about it. They just can't. And all of the history shows, again and again, that they adamantly will not do that. So there's something about this that it's like one of the Ten Commandments for them. Thou shalt never reveal the truth of those to the world. Now, back in the early years, this is an easy one to see why. You know, pretend Roswell happened, or Aztec of 1948 happened, which I believe it did. So you're the president, you're Harry Truman, and your top people come up to you and they inform you that they've recovered exotic technology not manufactured by our civilization. Okay, so just say you've got this heavy-duty thing to deal with. Are you going to tell the world? Even if you want to tell the world, you really can't. Because that becomes an unmanageable nightmare. First of all, you got the Soviet Union on the other side of the world, this little thing called the Cold War, and we certainly, here in the U.S., we're not willing to share atomic technology with the Soviets. Why the hell would you want to share something as exotic as alien technology? If you tell the world that you've got ET technology, it's going to be mighty hard to prevent that at some point from getting into the Soviet hands. So for that reason alone, they would not let the world know they've got this. But then there's the other issue. How do you reassure the world that they have nothing to fear when you yourself really don't know the answer to that? How are they going to know that in 1947, 48? They have no way of knowing ET motivations. They can't possibly have known. And then knowing what the social repercussions would be. All of these things would require for them, at least temporarily, to try to get a handle on this before they come up with their own game plan. But then here's the lovely thing about secrecy is that it tends to perpetuate itself. And it tends to create a profit also. So you've got this secret started, and maybe Truman might say, okay, well, in a couple of years we'll revisit this and we'll decide our plan. But by then, your black budget scientific communities come up with some nifty ways to improve integrated circuits based on what they found, or to create solid-state electronics, or high tensile fibers, or fiber optic, who knows. They'll get ideas, money-making ideas. And then suddenly, of course, your incentive for giving the secret up goes down to zero. because it's a goose that lays golden eggs. Why would you want to give it up? And then on top of that, what if other breakthroughs have occurred covertly? Let's say something that goes beyond our energy paradigm. What if some genius scientist has a eureka moment and says, oh, wow, we really don't need petroleum. We've got this electrogravitics really does work. Do you share that with the world? That takes down the petroleum industry. I think not. So now you've got this entire rubric of classified technology and science that they don't know how to share that with the world without it taking down so much of our global infrastructure. They just can't do it. So what they do instead is they keep working on it privately in the classified world, and they get farther and farther ahead of the rest of us poor slobs, and they become what I called in some of my books a breakaway civilization that is essentially broken away from Mars. It's not that they're all living on Mars in some, you know, alternative three scenario, but you know, the action is here on Earth, but they have their own culture in a lot of ways. They have their own technology, and they don't share with the rest of us. That's what I think.
That's what it looks like, and it seems to me a really volatile situation, and if they want to remain in control of it, they're going to have to start doing more steps towards disclosure.
You know, though, I actually think that we're actually getting closer than ever, because you have all this confluence of events that are happening at the same time. We got the Sirius movie that just came out, the Dr. Lear documentary that was just released for you to the world today. You have the citizens' hearing coming up. You also have the Vatican, who changed their views completely. But anyway, we're all fearful. We're all hopeful that's going to happen. The show is ending, sadly.